Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on that, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Evelina Horochwick. CMHA. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with the CMHA.
Sure. I've been working with Canadian Mental Health Association since 2017, so not a very long time. I started in community support work, and I've been working with clients in programs such as intensive case management, justice case management, community treatment orders, housing, and recently moved over to a position as a mental health educator. And there is sometimes movement through programs and we change our programs depending on the needs of the community or the funding and things like that. So I've currently gotten into this role as of last year. And lately I've been doing a lot of specialized trainings in terms of suicide prevention skills trainings. Since the pandemic occurred in March, we've been moving from face-to-face services to virtual education services. So a lot of the things we're doing, going to the community board and workplaces to provide educational workshops and trainings, we move those all to online virtual services through things like Zoom. And a lot of them are provided for free.
I was wondering, are there any myths surrounding mental health out there that you work to correct?
Absolutely. There's lots of myths and stigma surrounding mental health. It's funny because I was just discussing this week with someone that, if you start opening up, talking about mental health and talking about your mental health, a lot of people think that will attract issues rather than open up to having an open discussion about mental health. So a lot of people have a fear that if I start talking about my mental health or I open that up and other people talk to me, it's like it will create more issues rather than just having an open forum to discuss it. So let's say whether that's workplaces, whether that's, in families or communities in general. So there's a lot of secrecy. And a lot of people don't want to talk about it. I think they're more open talking about physical health issues and mental health issues.
Well, that's the thing, though. A lot of people perceive physical aspects of disabilities as something a person can already see and be consciously aware of, whereas with the mental health situation, they figure they have to open up and create something new in the equation. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah, absolutely. That's like, talking about, able body, someone who might look like they're maybe not going through something, but with in terms of mental health, it's when you open up the discussion, maybe you'll learn something about a person, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that's very important because mental health, there's no health without mental health, like whether it's physical health or mental health, they're both interconnected. And that's one of the things a lot of people don't take into account because our environment affects our physical health and it affects our mental health just as much as it would just affect our physical health. So it's just looking at it in a very different fashion and looking at it as a holistic perspective and not as a separate, like this is separate from the person's well-being or health.
So how do you go about overcoming the myths and stereotypes and the challenges associated with getting someone to open up about their mental health condition?
So it's interesting because not only do us as a culture and us as communities and us as society and us from influence have an idea or a stigma or a myth about mental health, but also individuals who experience issues and experience challenges with their own mental health have their own stigma and they have their own myths and they have their own challenges. So it's really, really important to ask questions, to be interested in learning about what the person is experiencing, because every single individual has a unique experience and they have their own perceived perceptions about how they look at themselves, how society looks at them, what they want, you know, and what their goals might be. So it's not necessarily talking only about the issues, but it's also talking about what kind of quality of life they're hoping for, what kind of, you know, just opening a discussion about questions and not making it seem so scary.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time doing this work, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I think anyone who gets, honestly, I think anyone who is open enough to go and walk through the doors of CMHA or walk somewhere and ask for help is the first step to recovery. And recovery looks different for every person. When I talk about recovery, I mean, like, maybe they're in the crisis point in their lives for whatever reason. And they're working, they're asking for help, they're doing all the things that they need to be doing to get to a point where they can get through it with some help. Because any success story is they're open about it, they're asking for help and they're getting that help. And what worries me is the people that don't ask and that they are in the background that we don't know about them, right? Because that's more concerning. But if you ask for help and you start your way, then I think that's the first step towards success.
So I'm guessing when a person's attitude is they need help and they want to change their quality of life, that's an ongoing thing. It's not, as some people take it, as, I can go in, have a couple of sessions, I'll be just fine sort of thing.
Right. And when I mentioned the word recovery, that's that could take weeks or months or even years, or it could be a lifelong process. It is absolutely different for every single person, depending on what it is and depending on what they want to and what they need. So say if, and they have to be ready to. They have to be ready to do certain things or to want to step forward into certain things. And if they're not ready at that moment, that's okay. Like that's okay. There's still time, you know. So that's why, programs like CMHA are meet the person where they're at and try to provide the services and focus on their goals and needs. And it's client centered, so it's not like we're going to tell you what to do and you have to do those things. We're going to provide direction. We're going to provide education, we're going to provide support, and we're going to be there. Like if you need to ask a question or need some more guidance, it's more like that, right? So it's very different, I think, than a lot of people perceive it to be. We mentioned stereotypes and stigma or surrounding about mental health and what help looks like. I think people are sometimes unaware, and maybe that prevents them from wanting to ask and take that step, because it is a hard step. But I think it's a lot more about the client than about the person than people assume.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay. Thank you very much, Cam, for having me.
My pleasure. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Melissa Vigar from BIST. So tell me a little bit about society.
Right. So, yeah, again, thank you for having us on. So the Brain Injury Society of Toronto, we're an agency located in Toronto who supports people with brain injuries and their families. So we run drop-in programs. Obviously, right now, that's all virtual. We run support groups. And then we have a few programs that are dedicated to looking at folks who are, you know, experiencing poverty because of their brain injury. So whether it be homelessness, housing crisis, poverty, we help them apply for financial assistance programs, help stabilize housing. And we also have a program specific for victims of intimate partner violence who receive their brain injury because of an assault.
So when it comes to that assault program you mentioned, what are some of the common results of a person's brain injury? Do they end up with things like post-traumatic stress, or is the result more physical typically?
Right. Well, it could be a combination of both. There's a really high correlation of people with brain injuries who also experience issues with mental health. Specifically, what we see in the program of victims of assault, there's certainly both, right? There'll be anxiety and depression related to their mental health, but there's also a lot of cognitive issues that come with brain injuries, which makes it harder for them to kind of stabilize their lives. So what we assist with is similarly helping them with any applications they need, helping them find supports, coordinate supports, you know, learn strategies to deal with the cognitive impairments they might have. So maybe they have a memory impairment, maybe have difficulty planning, organizing, things like that. So that's really where we come in. We kind of help. We're kind of like a functional tool that helps them get things organized in their life on track.
So how do you go about reaching out to someone who may be in this situation? I'd imagine it's especially difficult with the assault group, in so much as not everyone's going to talk about those issues openly.
Absolutely, yeah. So to be honest, where the program kind of started from, or kind of the springboard behind it, is we run a, you know, we have a women's support group, and that's, you know, any women with a brain injury is welcome to attend. But as we held these support groups, we did notice there was a common theme that there were a couple of women who had come to the group who had received their injuries because of an assault. And as such, we kind of did a bit more research and got some funding to have a support person dedicated to supporting people who were victims of assault. And she's done a lot of great legwork with connecting with shelters, systems, you know, places where people who are victims of assault might seek support. One of the things with brain injury is because it's invisible, it's often not diagnosed. So she's done some education around what it might look like if someone has a brain injury. And then reaching out to say, we're here, if they see anyone who they suspect might have a brain injury, that we can certainly assist that person.
So I'm guessing your work covers all types of brain injuries, ranging from a stroke to a concussion, to things of that nature.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's really, you know, far-reaching. It could be because of, you know, a fall, a stroke, brain cancer, tumors, you know, an anoxic brain injury if oxygen was cut off for some reason. Anything like that.
So, in your time with the society, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Such a great question. Yeah, I mean, we've certainly had a lot of success stories. I guess the first one that comes to mind is we had a gentleman who was spending his time either in the shelter system or just traveling on the TTC, really didn't have any place to go, didn't have any belongings, didn't have any identification. And so through our homelessness prevention program, we worked with him to, you know, help get his identification, help get his health card. And eventually we found him a place to live and connected him with support staff who were able to help him maintain that housing. So I think, you know, and he's still very much connected to our association and asks for support when he needs it. So I think that's one of our bigger success stories.
I am curious, though, how did he manage to ride the TTC if he was dealing with homelessness and poverty issues? I mean, that after a certain point, that does kind of run into money.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at it, it's, you know, if you just ride the subway back and forth, it's $3.75 for a day of somewhere to be, right? So Yeah, I don't know how he got on the subway. I imagine he paid that small fare, and then he had somewhere to be for a day, right?
So, how do you go about lifting people with brain injuries out of poverty, making sure they stay that way? Getting them there is probably the easier part than providing ongoing support in long term.
Right. Yeah. So, as an agency, our long term support is more based in the support groups and kind of providing them a place to interact socially with others. But what kind of the functional things that we do when we have somebody come into the program, especially if they don't have a diagnosed brain injury, or if they have been told in the past they had a brain injury but they didn't have any documentation. So what that does, it kind of limits their access to long-term ministry-funded supports. So one of the first things we do is we help them gather that information about their brain injury diagnosis, getting some paperwork sorted, and then we help them apply for long-term supports. Granted, there are wait lists, and certainly brain injury is something that requires more attention and more funding. However, there are some supports available, so we help kind of get them onto those supports so that they can have access to someone long-term.
So, if you could...
I talk really fast. Please slow me down if you need to.
Okay.
I just realized that.
It's quite all right. So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for the ongoing work, what would you say?
I think I would say that, you know, although our association and the Ontario Brain Injury Association and certainly all the associations across the province are really working hard to raise awareness about brain injury, it is still very much a hidden disability. It's still something that affects a large portion of the population, and it can be found in a lot of marginalized groups. So again, you know, a lot of folks with who are experiencing homelessness have a brain injury. So I think there just needs to be more funding spent on getting people the proper resources, you know, at the onset of injury and beyond, so that they're not kind of falling through the cracks later in life.
So, do you know offhand about how many people with brain injuries are living in poverty? Do you have any stats on that?
Yeah, so what I can tell you is there was a study done by St. Michael's Hospital a few years ago, and what they found was 50% of the Toronto brain injury population, or sorry, 50% of the homelessness population had sustained a brain injury at some point in their life. So that's a pretty high number. And in that study, about 70% of the individuals became homeless after their brain injury. So it really paints a picture of how quickly someone's life can start to fall apart following a brain injury.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Windsor Youth Center is a free drop-in community center for homeless and at-risk youth in the Windsor Essex area. The WYC assists people with many important things, such as replacing identification, resume writing, as well as providing meals, snacks, and a safe space for youth to come together. The Windsor Youth Center is located at 1247 Wyandotte Street East and is open Monday to Friday from 5 p.m. until 10 p.m. For more information, visit their website at downtownmission.com under the services or give them a call at 226-674-0006.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on this, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Evelina Horochwick from CMHA, and Melissa Vigor from BIST.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Leslie Robertson. We'll be sharing a little bit of the history of her disabilities work. So tell me a little bit about the history of your disabilities work.
Okay. I started out in this work, I was helping a friend who was severely disabled by a brain tumor, and I was trying to help him find work and cope with his disabilities from his tumor, and got hired by a company that was doing Jobs Ontario for people who were disabled and on welfare. And of course, Mike Harris, when he came in to office, first thing he did was shut down Jobs Ontario, because he didn't think there was any point in getting jobs for people who were on welfare. So the company that then hired me was called Handidactus, and they're based out of Montreal, and they're part of the Wheelchair Olympics of Quebec, and they had one arm of their organization that did disability awareness training and site audits for barrier-free design. And they trained me to do the training and the audits, and I worked for them from 1995 till April of 2006, at which point they said they were busy gearing up for the 2008 Olympics and didn't have time to manage my office anymore. And I was the entire company outside of Quebec. Everybody else was in Quebec. I was the only English-speaking member of the organization, and I was the only person outside of Montreal. So they said they didn't have time for my stuff anymore, and how would I like to work for myself? So starting April of 2006, I started Disability Awareness Consultants and just took off running, writing training manuals, doing disability awareness training, and doing site audits for barrier-free design. I wrote the training program that the province uses still to train all provincial and municipal employees called May I Help You? And I wrote and performed in a video that the province uses to give out to employers called Talk to Me. I've just been doing that stuff. I did it from, like I say, 2006 up until the pandemic started in March, and then I realized nobody's going to do this kind of work for a good while now. We're going to be, you know, just basically, you know, waiting for the pandemic to be over. And since I just turned 69 on Canada Day, I figure by the time anybody gets back to doing disability awareness training and site audits, I'm going to be in my 70s and I'm not going to be interested. So I just retired when everything started in March, or started to shut down in March, I guess.
So in this work, what were some of the most common sight barriers you did find in terms of accessibility?
Well, you would think it would be stairs. And sometimes there are flights of stairs, different places, that's true. But in a lot of cases, it's more turning radius. People will say, oh yeah, it's all nice and flat, you can get in here. But then it turns out that, you know, once you go through the door, there's a wall right in front of the chair, and you can't fit the wheelchair in it. It won't turn around, won't get past the wall. Or they'll say, yeah, we're nice and level and flat, and you go in there, and the angle is so steep that you cannot, you know, maneuver the chair up and down the angle. You know, there'll be a ramp, and then somebody will say, oh, yeah, we have a ramp. And it turns out what they really got is like a ski slope. It's no ramp. And so, you know, to use it in a wheelchair would be dangerous. You could tip over or just get stuck. So, you know, it just, it's just a lack of awareness. I mean, if people have a flight of stairs, they know it. And they could say, yeah, we got steps, you can't get in or something. But what they don't know is when they've got what we would call a pinch point, where you just can't get past it because it's too tight of a turn, or where the ramp is too steep, or there's a lot of things that are not just related to wheelchairs, where maybe the lighting is too bright or too dim so that people who have visual impairments can't see. or maybe the environment is very noisy so that people who wear hearing aids or have hearing loss can't hear what's going on and can't understand what's being said around them because it's too noisy. So, you know, there's lots of issues that don't necessarily have to do with people who use chairs, but it might be something like on a stairwell. I can do stairs a little as long as I've got something where I can hold on both sides, because I'm not using my wheelchair or a walker and I'm on a flight of stairs. I have to be able to hold on both sides while I drag myself up and down the stairs. Well, if you've got a big wide staircase and a banister only on one side and nothing in the middle, then there's only one side for me to hold on to and I'm not safe.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time doing accessibility audits, has there been any success that stands out for you?
That's a funny question, and it's kind of a discouraging answer, because what I found in many cases is people will pay for the audit and be very pleased with the information that they get, and then they put it in a drawer and they never do anything with it. You know, I'll come back a year or two later to the same place and find that they haven't made any changes. So it's hard for me to say whether anybody has done anything really good in terms of removing barriers. One client I know that really paid attention was the Ontario Science Centre, and they were good. Their biggest issues there were actually not so much the physical access, but the signage that they needed to help people find their way around. And they did make big strides on improving their signage. After I told them, you know, when I was there doing my site audit, the one question I heard over and over from other visitors was, where are the bathrooms? And so when I told them that as part of my audit, they put up much better signage for where are the bathrooms. So, you know, they paid attention and they did good things. But a lot of organizations, they like to have the information. They like to be able to say, oh, yeah, we had a site audit done. We are very progressive. But then they don't do anything with the information. So it's kind of frustrating. I was on Yonge Street, and I was actually with other friends who use chairs, and we're sitting outside the store, and I'm talking in through the open door to the woman in the store, and I said, why don't you get something, a stopgap or something, so that we can get up this one big step into your store? And she said, there's no need to. People with disabilities don't come into my store. And I said, well, of course we don't. How are we supposed to get up the step? You don't realize how many people are scooting by your door who might look in and think, gee, I wish I could go in there and shop, but I can't get up the step, so forget it. I'll keep going till I find someplace that I can get in.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
In particular, my friends, Leslie's story is a reminder that disability equality and the push therein is a lifetime practice. You can't just believe in disability rights and equality and strength and dignity one day and then, poof, the next day you're onto something else. Fact is, those with the greatest hearts for the work are the ones who will make it happen, rain, shine, or any force of nature in between. Truth is, they are the ones changing the world. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.